He says something very similar, but he adds on that, you know, if, and again, this is a paraphrase, but that if you don't decide what you're going to worship, then someone else is going to pick it for you. And I think that this is reflective very much in this sort of relationship of irony and consumerism that you see in the hipster, but you see in rich everyone else, where what is actually central to one's identity is appearance or appearances, right? Appearances through one's style, how one chooses to eat, you know, what one chooses to, you know, what's kind of social categories one sort of chooses. So a good example would be like one's dietary restrictions or decisions, right? Like, am I going to like join the vegan club or the vegetarian club or whatever it's going to be? You know, what kind of music am I going to be into? What kind of this stuff? But all this stuff is chosen within the context of like what is about to be popular, which is subsumed within the context, like within the umbrella of popularity, right? Like, you know, I don't like to talk about music for a second. Like, I don't think that many hipsters are listening to like Babylonian era, like string poetry, right? Like, there's certainly stuff that sits out of the purview of interest of like, realistically speaking, of like, you know, the hipster culture or the ironic living culture, because it's just like not really marketable. But like, God only knows, Warpole talks considerably about nostalgia and the fact that these nostalgias have become extremely tight. And I think that that's a reflection of, or potentially a kind of manipulation in a sort of consumerist sense of constantly recycling products, right? And if people, if the forefront of, or if the vanguard of the ironic culture thinks that they are like discovering something new, then it is an incredibly efficient way of reusing products, of reusing media, and within a consumerist context, because you can basically reach back every 7 or 8 years and be like, okay, we're bringing this style forward, we're bringing this film forward, we're bringing this old music forward, and we're just going to keep recycling it, keep reusing it, and repeating this process over and over again. And all it requires from the consumer is, one, obviously purchasing and involvement in the kind of market, whatever it looks like, but also, two, not committing too much to any particular new fad or trend or media interest.
It's interesting thinking about the non-commitment, not necessarily from like the hipster's perspective, but from the consumer's perspective. Like, the consumer has a tacit responsibility not to really take too seriously a particular form of art or a genre or something like that. Like, the consumer can't become an aficionado or someone who like becomes a scholar of something. They can't take up lute music for the rest of their life and like pick up the lute and really start learning how to play it, because that would take them out of the consumer cycle that constructs the whole sort of edifice itself. Whatever the market puts forward, they have to buy, or else you just can't explain the existence of this market, right? And it's interesting too, the nostalgia cycle kind of tightening because of I wonder if this gets it starting from the fact that, because one of the other things that Wempel says too is that the hipster really is a byproduct of the internet age. And one of the things that the internet age ushers in is remix culture, right? So not only do you have the digitization of information, which can be easily replicated, you know, when you can copy and paste text with 2 keystrokes, but you can do that just as well with music and whatnot too. And even going back into the late 20th century, a lot of like sampling machines and whatnot, you know, I'm thinking of like hip hop and whatnot and like jungle and stuff like that, sampling old records. They can reproduce these things in infinite mutations. And the internet allows you to distribute that. And it kind of teaches people how to do that by distributing. You go out and you find this stuff and you remix it. internet culture essentially is remix culture, and so I wonder if that has something to do with it.
I think that's part of it. I mean, I think in some ways it's a good like defense for some of the like, you know, art and cultural aspects that we might like consider within the framework of irony. Also to the kind of people who are re-involved, let's just take the example of like remixing and creating something new. Like that is actually like a new creation. I think that the important point with that, I guess, would be this, is people who really go down the avenue, even if it's not like the whole meaning of their life in like an authentic sense, it is something that they take seriously. It's not like an inside joke, effectively. However, I think that there is a component of irony that's what we're talking about here, where that is like, it's most obviously seen through like dress, and I'm guilty of this. Most obvious one too, like I enjoy it. I think it's really, I think it's fun. It's super lighthearted. Is taking like vintage clothes shopping, right? And like reusing clothing, but not particularly like what's really common and what I do too. Again, I like it. It's fun, but I kind of recognize the irony or the kind of weirdness of it is like finding like graphic t-shirts, which are ugly. Like they are, like they have like poorly done graphics, or they're kind of weird, or they're just really poorly dated. They don't stand up well, and wearing that because it's stupid, right? Like being able to look at it and be like, oh yeah, like this is stupid. Like it's like, so it's hilarious. It's kind of funny. It's a joke, but it's not really a style. Like it's not being worn because I'm like, this is like stylistically interesting looking. It's good. It's like, it's being worn because is, as you know, as Warpole mentions, basically this exact kind of example, it's referring to something else.
Right. It's referring to the fact that you think it's ugly, or the fact that it's like, it's kind of a little joke. You'll get a chuckle out of it. It does. It doesn't have so much to do with the way that it's incorporated.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's like, that is the more common structure of ironic living. However, I do want to say, and maybe we can take in our last little bit of the show, we can take this avenue, which is this, you brought up at the beginning, we both brought it up, you talked about it briefly, that this article is from 2012. So this article is over 10 years old. It was kind of written at the height of hipsterism, the height of social media being, you know, having coalesced but still being kind of new at the same time. And I think that you brought up another term earlier. You brought up the term nihilism. And I would actually venture to say that there is a component of ironic, of the culture of irony, that is actually transitioning more towards a culture of nihilism is my, you know, that's my big dramatic prediction. That's my observation. And I think that the two are directly related. They're like sibling as the parent of the other is probably the better way of saying it. There's a lot of overlap, but I think the big component is that cultures of irony, of self-reference, of not taking things, life, values, society, themselves seriously, eventually the high wears off, eventually the laughs die down, and what people are left with is a very empty feeling cultural landscape and self-reflection. You know, I'm trying to think about how to articulate this example, but have you ever watched, like, I'm sure listeners have ever watched like a Family Guy episode from like recently, or even like the mid-2010s especially? They're brutal, they're terrible in my opinion, but they're also incredibly self-aware. Like that is the whole joke, is they are just constantly making fun of themselves, constantly jabbing at the audience, constantly jabbing at their stories, at the animation, at the structure. Oh, Family Guy is all about the little like vignette bits. Oh, we're gonna make fun of the fact that we do vignette bits. Everybody kind of hates it and it's stupid, and most of the time it's not actually funny, right? So we're gonna refer to that. We're gonna refer to, like, you know, the stories being the same and the characters never changing and blah blah blah, all this kind of, and all the absurdity and how it's just like dumb and late, terribly written, and we're gonna refer to that within our own show. We're gonna write about how you're basically crappy writers and all this kind of stuff. There's something really, I think, when you think about that kind of media, and that's what, you know, most people are absorbing, consuming, all that kind of stuff, because most people in modern societies, especially in the West and many other parts of the world as well, do consume a lot of media. Like, that is the, you know, enormous amount. Has a huge impact on the world. There's something extremely empty about that kind of media. And I think that it does translate eventually into a kind of cultural nihilism. And as we're both millennials, I don't know if this is your experience, but I know it's mine, from people in and around my age group and younger, the tone that I get from a lot of people in terms of their general outlook, perspective on the world, is things are going to crap, basically, right? Like, things are going badly, people are unhappy, the world is going to come to an end. There's a lot of apocalyptic talk and thinking. And I think that that is, in part, at the very least, an outgrowth of the culture of irony. We've talked about this before, about with the context of, you know, philosophy of media and theory of media theory. But we've talked about how modern media, starting with typography, but especially with the rise of electronic media, starting with radio, television, but particularly becoming more pertinent with the rise of the internet and then social media, is that the world becomes a smaller place. Not obviously for listeners, not physically, but the issues, concerns, opinions, whatever it might be, of the whole world are now things that you might interact with, which was something completely unheard of 100 years ago, more or less, right? And I think that this gives people a kind of warped view of their own position in the world, if that kind of makes sense. Things, I remember we've talked in the past, we've done, I think, a couple shows directly on or about Neil Postman, who was a media theorist. Basically, you know, he brought up with the rise of electronic media or electronic communications, that suddenly things that really weren't your concern in any realistic sense became important to you. So suddenly the horrifying murder that happened on the other side of the continent, big scandal, this is now like a big deal. Have you heard about this? This thing that happened? You're never going to meet anybody that was involved in all likelihood. You're never going to like hear about it again after this little like round of discussions. It's not actually important to you and your personal existence. A controversial claim, I know, but from this perspective, yeah. But it radically changes how you see yourself and the world around you. And I think that, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to interject. You know, I'm surprised we didn't do an episode
I got
that submarine.
That, which is hilarious.
Do you remember that?
Exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I'm interested, like, there were news networks that were putting timers on how much air they have left in there. This is on the news. This is what we're supposed to be being informed about. But now it's, something gets thrown out and it's kind of a story around a campfire that everyone is talking about now.
Sub disaster debacle is probably the better way of putting it.
Mm-hmm.
I should say to us is I'm not resistant to this kind of thing. I got super interested in that, was watching like video essays about this whole thing for a little while after, and was really consuming a lot of media around it. But I also think that on some level, that whole situation is encapsulates a lot of what we're talking about here in a kind of way, because it's like a bunch of people, a bunch of very wealthy people went on a excursion with a not very tried and tested organization to visit a eroding relic at the bottom of the ocean. So a very dangerous, dangerous journey that is people are only concerned with now within the context of media, right? Basically from a movie, more or less, from a blockbuster, 1990s blockbuster. So going, like, you know, inspired heavily by media to go and visit this thing that's not really, like, that is currently, like, literally, like, wasting away at the, you know, the near the bottom of the ocean, not actually, but very, very deep in the ocean. And it's, I think it encapsulates a lot of this kind of, like, fervor of, like, catching experiences and all that kind of stuff. And then for it to be, for the, and then I think the bigger point is then for it to become a, like, a media sensation, like you're saying, like, and everybody's talking about it, everybody's concerned about it. And yeah, I mean, it's tragic, but it's also like this was like a terrible idea. If I told you or our listeners, hey, I'm going to build like a budget lunar rocket in my backyard, obviously this is a bit of exaggeration compared to the Titan sub, but for anyone that looks into it, like, it was just not good. Yeah, it was bad. Like, it was bad. And say I build this rocket and it explodes in my backyard. Like, what's the real meaning behind that, taking it in and of itself, other than, like, frankly, I'm kind of an idiot for doing that? It would absolutely be turned into, like, it's like we're constantly bombarded by, like, non-stories, like, non-relevant, not particularly interesting stories. I know I'm probably being a little bit, like, controversial here, but I think that that's kind of relates back to this ironic structure, which is dealt with, this nihilistic structure now that we're, like, heading into. Again, the two are deeply related, where nothing really matters. So just pick up on what is, like, the most entertaining right now or popular, and, like, pump that as much as you can.
Yeah, whatever comes down the stream, you know. It's interesting we're talking about irony in this case, because when this whole story broke, everyone has a side. The interesting thing about the Titan submarine case was that, as much as we're talking about irony, this was a case where basically the whole, I don't want to say the whole world, that's actually a bit of an exaggeration. It's an exaggeration, but what seemed like the whole world came behind caring about something, about being very passionate. You know, these people are dying. Like, I know there were lots of, it actually, and probably this contributed to most of the hubbub about it, was there was this controversy of, like, you know, do you think that rich people doing this, risking their lives in this stupid project, you know, did they kind of have it coming? And there were the people of, like, nobody deserves to die. Like, that's just common sense. Nobody deserves to die. Nobody can say that. But then there's also, like, okay, well, you're kind of like, there's no way, you know, like, there's no way you think you're getting out of this, stepping into a death trap, right? So there was this kind of, like, schadenfreude about it. And so people were divided kind of on these lines of caring a lot about these people who died, and people taking a kind of glee in it. And maybe, like, it's a bit ironic in that sense. Like, people aren't really celebrating this, but there's still this kind of, like, okay, yeah, like, when people die, that is tragic, but I don't roll, you know, I don't mourn every time someone on the news dies. So people who are super passionate about defending this, or who have taken that side, are kind of going a bit, you know, it's a bit much, why these people in particular, are you defending them and stuff like that? And just, like, having general criticisms of the whole event. But again, the point is that either way you cut it, these people are involved. And some of them might be involved ironically through some, like, kind of trolling or whatever. But most of the people here seemed to really be, you know, kind of fired up about it. They were not doing it ironically. We would say they were in it unironically. They unironically cared about this stuff. And yet, it still seems like there's something ironic about the kind of purposelessness or pointlessness of this all. Like, it's just, you know, it could have been anything. It probably could have been anything at this particular point in time. People just needed something to kind of run through the cycle or whatever. And I guess, like one of the, I don't know, like one of the terms you might use for this is that there's a kind of post-ironic caring about it. Like people understand, like maybe this isn't the most important thing, but at least the world cares about something. At least, as pointless as this is, there's something that we care about. I don't know. I mean, it's just it's an interesting paradox in ironic ways of living, is the Titan submarine kind of fiasco.
I think that you hit on something there that spoke to me. And, you know, what are the dangers of irony, as Warpole kind of talks about? Like, why are we so concerned with, you know, with irony, and why is it actually dangerous? And I think you hit on one point there of like what the danger of irony is. And I think it's best to state it through the kind of opposing view. I brought up David Foster Wallace earlier. There are other people who are within this movement, but a kind of counter movement to irony coming about was what was called the New Sincerity Movement. That was like kind of in the 90s and like early 2000s, which was basically like, you know, emphasizing the importance of making personal commitments, of actually caring about other people. That's the simplest way I can put it. That's not saying that you're always going to be right. It's not accepting, but it is about, it's kind of like a rearticulation, honestly, of authenticity, but more of in a social kind of values context, where it's basically saying, hey, like certain values are important, right? And generally within a kind of very moralistic framework. Certain values are important. Certain qualities are important. Ironic perspectives, which obviously lead, like we've been saying, have a sort of relationship to nihilistic perspectives eventually, have a very hard time allowing for genuine, like what you might even call humanistic values. It's very hard to actually care about people and live ironically, because like, why? And you see that, so at the Titan submarine, where a lot of the content relating to the Titan submarine, even when people thought these people still might be alive or just after they died, a lot of the heavily consumed content, as you said, like there were certainly some people who genuinely care, there were some people who were really concerned, but a lot of people, I would honestly say that the general masses of people viewing this saw it as kind of entertainment and a joke. And there were like, for like right off the bat, there were like plenty of memes and commentary and like all that kind of stuff, basically making fun of the whole debacle, the whole situation, which is interesting. Before we end for today, is interesting because it's concerning, because what that structure does is allows people to acceptably have very callous orientations to very real tragedies, for lack of a better way of saying it. And I know it's not really realistic to expect that, you know, everybody is going to genuinely care about everything all the time and that kind of stuff. But, you know, when a bunch of people make a poor decision, basically, and one of them is very reckless, perhaps all the more, some people could argue, and die, and the response from the general community is, you know, this is a joke. These people are a joke. That is a structure that has implications that it doesn't take someone a long time to think about how that can be stretched to more, like even more sort of nefarious dispositions towards the world. And I think in a lot of times they are, right? And I think that's one of the problems with irony and what we call it, like ironic nihilism, where and also as we've kind of brought into this discussion, like the presentation of like just the absorption in worldwide networks of media, is that, you know, very real tragedies, very real, serious, concerning situations that, you know, ideally you would think people would want to be sincere about. The immediate disposition that is taken is actually, you know, one of coming very close to the situation, but dehumanizing it at the same time.
Right. Yeah. And I think your concern with that is, I mean, it's perfectly on the money there. People get practice in comporting themselves in this way in the world, and they get practice being a part of a society that encourages that or kind of sweeps them along in that. And that's not good. I would not want to it's concerning. I mean, as much as it's a function of a lot of the infrastructure that goes on, like people around them and the media that they consume and whatnot. I mean, I don't know how much we can fault particular individuals for that, but at the same time, as soon as you become aware of that, you can turn around and try and do something about it. You can be aware of the media influences that are on you, and you can try to approach things in a different way and see things in different lenses. And ironically, take a distance from the way irony distances you from things.
Maybe we'll all be a little bit less ironically positioned after this discussion, maybe be a bit more sincere about our values, beliefs, and concerns for other people, mm-hmm. instead of thinking of everything as basically a giant joke. This has been the Canadian Philosophy Show. We appreciate you listening, and we hope you tune in next week.
Bye.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
The Cultures Youth Panel are thrilled to announce that this year's Ignite Festival will be taking over the Cultures Historic Theatre at 1895 Venable Street from May 15th to May 18th. Ignite is an eclectic festival that celebrates excellence in the emerging arts and is curated entirely by members of the Youth Panel at the Culch, made up of theatre performers, filmmakers, writers, poets, dancers, musicians, visual artists, and more, all between the ages of 13 and 30. Performances this year will include short plays, monologues, poetry, some stand-up comedy, live music, dance, a short film program, and drag performances. Tickets are currently available through the Cultures box office in person, by phone, or online. Tickets are by donation on a sliding scale. Hope to see you there.
This is Bird Note. Morning dew sparkles on the leaves of an eastern hardwood forest. It's May, and the chorus of spring birdsong is nearing its peak. The rich notes of a Carolina wren carry through the story. A year-round resident, it's been singing since the end of winter. A chestnut-sided warbler joins in. It has returned from winter in Costa Rica to the same patch of woods in which it nested last year. Now, we hear a scarlet tanager. This striking long-distance migrant completed its journey from Bolivia in early May. There are the resounding notes of an ovenbird, letting us know it has returned safely from Belize after a long flight across the Gulf of Mexico. And the whistled notes of an eastern wood peewee are unmistakable. How different these woods must look to the peewee after a winter in the lowland forest of Peru. By late May, the last of the migrants has arrived from the tropics. All have journeyed across the continents, bringing us the gift of their songs. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.